This Voice of San Diego podcast is brought to you by Manolatus Nelson Murphy, Advertising and Public Relations. As a nonprofit news organization, we depend on our members, foundations, and sponsors like M&M to provide funding to support the investigative journalism you expect from Voice of San Diego. We are very grateful for all of our supporters, and we will recognize them during the show. M&M is run by Tony Manolatus, Bob Nelson, and Kelly Murphy Lampkin, who bring a vast network and decades of experience to developers, public agencies, campaigns, and others. M&M bridges the gap between clients and the people whose influence matters most. M&M develops successful strategies and implements cost-effective tactics to help clients achieve their goals. The firm specializes in public affairs PR and advertising, with an emphasis on media relations, crisis communications, community engagement, and cross-platform marketing. Our reporters at Voice of San Diego have heard from Tony and Bob a lot over the years. Tony, Bob, and Kelly are supporters of Voice of San Diego. Learn more about their firm at mnmadpr.com. And if you like Voice of San Diego's work and want to become a sponsor too, contact us at development@voiceofsandiego.org.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast, where we make sense of local politics, schools, housing, public safety, the civic issues that impact the life of a San Diego resident. We break it down so you can understand it and make educated decisions.
Everything that goes into our investigative reporting, the journalists, public records requests, the data crunching, and this very show depends on the support of people like you because we're a nonprofit news organization. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to those of you listening on News Radio 600 KOGO. My name is Scott Lewis. I'm here with my friend Andrew Keats.
What's up, buddy?
My other friend Sarah Libby.
Hey.
Hi. So San Diego had a couple of its finest representatives at the White House this week. County Supervisor Kristen Gaspar and Escondido Mayor Sam Abed spoke to President Trump about California's laws restricting how law enforcement can cooperate with federal immigration agents. And I hate that we have to do this, but it's colloquially described as sanctuary city and state laws. Yeesh. The whole point of these laws, of course, is to make sure that the unauthorized immigrants who are here still cooperate with police if they witness or fall victim to criminal activities. You know, so if a woman is being abused or something, you want her to be able to call the police, right? Kind of the goal. Mm-hmm. So Sam Abed, we wanted to get right to this. He had some news for the president about this theory.
This narrative that sanctuary city will allow more immigrants to report crime is fake news, Mr. President.
Fake news.
Spoke his language.
Yeah.
Spoke old Trump's language.
Speaking of commonly used terms that have no meaning whatsoever.
Yeah. Unfortunately for us this time, this is not the journalists spewing this fake news. It's not the mainstream media. This is actually what the cops say, what police.
Among others.
Yeah, exactly. All local law enforcement, let's be clear, all local law enforcement says the same thing. Here, for example, was Police Chief Dave Nislight in this very studio with Andy and I after he got appointed police chief, came in and talked to us about this and many other issues. Here's what he says about why this is so important.
Let me be clear, because our policy has been in existence, I want to say, right around 20 years. So when we contact somebody, we do not ask immigration status. That is not going to change under me. I want people to feel very comfortable calling the San Diego Police Department if they're a victim of a crime, irregardless of their status in this country. Also, I want people to feel comfortable if they're stopped, driving a car or walking down the street. That's not going to change.
Not going to change.
Well, what does he know about law enforcement?
Only 30 years.
Yeah, it's just Sam Abed knows better.
Yes, it's similar to what Shelley Zimmerman has said and told us. Like he said, it's been their policy for decades.
Bill Gore
has said something similar.
Yeah. Uncontroversially, the policy for a long time.
Yeah.
Kind of became a hot ticket thing in like the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
But
now we've talked about the issue of the word sanctuary city, right? I don't need to go through my problems with that word.
Right.
There's no city that are sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants. But this whole thing at the White House happened to coincide this week with the San Diego City Council, which decided to sign on to the state's, you know, defense of these laws as the Trump administration is suing.
Sign on in that they support it, but that they also missed the deadline of actually getting involved.
They've taken a vote to acknowledge that they'd like to sign on.
Yeah.
Sometime.
Ask the city attorney to do something. Whatever you can do. April 6th was the deadline to do this, but both the city and the county missed that, but still wanted to get in the fight.
Yeah. It's crazy because it's so significant.
It's almost like there's a lot of symbolic fighting going on.
Yeah.
But this one, and the city council was clearly upset that San Diego was being referred to as being supportive of Trump in this.
Yes.
When they're San Diego, not the other San Diego, the county.
Yes.
So
lots of confusion on the overlapping jurisdictions of local government.
On what they can actually achieve. It was a 5-2 vote. So the mayor was opposed, but he doesn't actually get to veto this. He was opposed and he released a statement saying San Diego is not a sanctuary city. San Diego is one of the safest big cities in the country with public safety policies that have worked under both Republican and Democratic administrations. So that point, that sentence, San Diego is not a sanctuary city. Okay, so that wording implies that there are some. And San Diego's not.
Right.
But if there are some, San Diego is one.
I mean, unless there's some very specific definition that includes some cities and excludes San Diego.
So I asked.
Right. It sounds like we're just going on, have we officially voted to call ourselves this fake thing? And Faulkner saying, no, we have not held
Never
an official
vote
on this fake term. But in practice, you know, we have a police chief saying that we protect immigrants.
And right.
Speaking of which, Voice of San Diego is not fake news.
No.
Right? It's just not.
No, exactly.
Because
we haven't declared.
We haven't declared that we are.
So I asked the mayor's staff, I said, what is the definition of sanctuary city? If you're so sure that we're not one, what is one? He said, and they responded with this statement. They said, sanctuary city does not have a standardized definition.
Well,
you're kidding.
So these are written down in front of me. So there's a stunning parallel here. The first sentence of the first message is San Diego is not a sanctuary city.
Yeah.
The first sentence of the next statement, sanctuary city does not have a standardized definition.
Well,
okay.
That's one way to handle it. Yeah. So this is the one, this is the next sentence that got, the next two sentences really intrigued me. It says, this is the statement from the mayor's office. It is often meant to describe, this term is often meant to describe municipalities that do not cooperate with federal immigration officials. We don't consider San Diego to be a sanctuary city because our police department works with everyone, including federal law enforcement agencies. So is he saying there that they do cooperate with immigration agents, which would be news to the police chief?
Yeah, I'm just...
Well, sort of. I mean, I reported 2 weeks ago that they share data, for instance, with
Border
Patrol.
I'm just so confused because Kevin Faulkner has spoken out about Trump's rhetoric on immigrants in particular and has worked hard to push back on it. And I don't think he would be willing to join the Trump's side of the lawsuit. No. I mean, we could ask them. They haven't said one way or the other. But he's also not willing to join the other side. It's just like a very strange line he's walking where he clearly seems opposed to some of this, but he's not willing to say that he really hates it either.
Well, also keep in mind that the context here is the effect of SB 54. And if we were discussing SB 54, this statement, we don't consider San Diego to be a sanctuary city because our police department works with everyone, or it is often meant to describe municipalities that do not cooperate with federal immigration officials. We have outlined ad nauseum the many ways in which SB 54 continues to allow municipalities to cooperate with
these task forces,
with task forces, with the various crimes that jails can continue to cooperate with each other.
They can call them and say this guy's going to get out. They can with warrants, they can hold them, all kinds of things.
Even by this standard, SB 54 is not a sanctuary law.
But yeah, that's the thing, is that like we're talking about a state law. Every city in the state of California is subject to this law. So like whether or not there are individual cities is moot. Like every city in the state is subject to this law.
Right. Yeah.
So
and this law doesn't even fit this definition.
Right.
There is obviously an instinct, and Bonnie Dumanis had this too. I asked her on a debate stage whether she, you know, would support what the county supervisors voted to do, which is join this Trump side. And she said, no, stay out of it, both sides. And like, I can see the tendency to want to say like, they're both just going crazy, stay out of it. But this is, and that's kind of like the Chris Kate take, right? Don't get involved with any of these amicus briefs. The city councilman, Chris Kate, is always saying that. But this one is like very specifically regarding what city employees can and can't do.
Yeah.
It's perfectly natural to have a stance on what your employees should do or not.
Yeah, this isn't about like, I'm trying to think of a, like the travel ban. It's like, well, look, our local law enforcement doesn't have a role there. Yes. Our local law enforcement has a role in this. It's a question of like what role you'd like them to have.
It's even more clear than the border wall, right? Like yeah. The border wall was in San Diego city limits, but it's, you know, not a federal, it's not a local issue necessarily, except for the price we pay to take care of it or whatever. But this one is literally part of what you do and what you oversee. Yeah. So we continue to grapple with this concept, and obviously Kristen Gaspar has seen some opportunities politically, but also just maybe has tapped into her own passions about the issue that we hadn't seen before. So this is going to be a continuing theme. There's a lot of claims, a lot of fact checks to be done about them. So thanks to all of you who donated in our spring campaign. We hit our campaign goals for the fall, and we're very happy about that.
Spring.
Is that what I said?
You said fall.
Oh, sorry. Our spring campaign. So yes, it is spring. Baseball, all that.
No football.
A lot of bad surf and weird skies, cloudy skies. Sorry. And the National Weather Service put up a thing saying that why is June gloom happening in May?
Yeah, it was absurd. June gloom in May with a intero bang. What the heck is wrong with these people?
Welcome to San Diego, National Weather Service. Our guest today is India Thusi. She's an assistant professor at the California Western School of Law. She uses anthropological methodology, she says, to do legal analysis and examine the policing of sexuality and gender. She wrote a commentary for us this week, pretty good, about this whole issue we've been debating and discussing about sex work versus human trafficking, and whether there is a concept of sex work beyond those being coerced or literally physically bullied into or slavery.
Yeah, she says very clearly that there is a distinction and that it is quite dangerous to conflate the two.
Yeah, so we'll talk to her. But first, we wanted to talk about the local elections and the effort to the county supervisors. We did never been in the news this much in the ever.
Yeah,
there's the Hep A stuff this week about their activity on that. We're gonna talk about that. But there's this thing with the national stuff. So
Do you think people in City Hall are happy?
Yes, City Hall.
Like, they do.
Can we do this for a little while?
City's like, woohoo.
Like county. Journalists realize that there's a county government also.
So the race, District 4, I think, is the hottest race. There's 5 county supervisor seats. There are 2 seats really being fought for right now. Mm-hmm. District 4 is the one that covers most of the city of San Diego, and the effort is to replace Ron Roberts, right?
Yeah.
So, Sarah, explain to us the difference in what the county races versus the city races, and what matters right now in the primary.
Yeah, so because of some of the election reforms that happened, seems like 10 years ago, but I suppose it was only 2.
Yeah.
The city races will all go to November just by right. And so there are some races at the county level, you know, in addition to this being an open seat for the first time in a really long time, that will be decided in June. So the big one of those is DA, the sheriff race is also one of them. And technically, it would be possible for these county supervisor races to be finished in June, but a candidate would have to get over 50% of the vote. And because there are, you know, a handful of candidates in those races, we don't really think that's likely.
Yeah. So I keep getting this question like, wait, is this, you know, is this going to get solved in
June? I've had multiple people say which races can be decided in June and which cannot.
So,
and the answer is the city of San Diego races, of which there are a handful of city council races, cannot be decided in June. 99% to one would still result in that 1% going to November. And any of the county races could be decided in June, although the supervisor, the D4 supervisor race almost certainly will not, and the other races almost certainly will.
Yeah. So in the city, basically, the big drama is something like the District 2 city council race to see who advances to the runoff, you know, one of the Democrats probably versus Lori Zaff. The two runoff races are the two in the District 8 race to replace, what's his name?
David Alvarez.
David Alvarez.
Oh, yeah, that guy. One of the other confusing things is that everyone seems fixated on the stadium Soccer City issue and the how should I vote? What's happening? I'm getting all these mail pieces about it, and that's not something that's going to be decided.
I bugged them. I was like, "What do you guys forget?" And they're like, "Oh no. The you know, people are paying attention now. It's a lot easier to win over people right now than it is to convert them if they've been, you know, if they've gone to the other side. So we'll just get on board now." So
you're not voting on it in June.
No, nothing like that. So yes, the big one, district attorney race, we've talked a lot about. But the two candidates that will move on in this District 4 race is a big question. So we've finished now three of the profiles of the candidates in the race. Lisa Halberstadt's done a good job of pulling together those. This week we ran the profile of Nathan Fletcher. A good piece. Basically, Lisa had the task to go and look at what Fletcher has been doing since he left the mayor's race, the second one that he lost in 2013, and what his life's been like since then. Really interesting. You know, he had formed a foundation. He got laid off from Qualcomm. Obviously he got married. A lot of different things happened. So a great piece on that, but really sort of structured like that point being like Miki Kasparian had told him, this is the labor leader, had told him back then, like, you just haven't been a Democrat long enough. We can't trust you. You need to go build your bona fides and maybe run for county supervisor or something. He's like, okay. So yeah. He did all of that.
That's happening.
And now Mickey's spending maybe even more money trying to bury him. Bonnie DeManis, so we had her on the interview last week. That was fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a time.
And then Omar Passens, he's got some momentum, it seems like. He's a land use attorney.
He's knocked on a lot of doors. He's running a very grassroots campaign, I would say, at this point. However, if you spend time in the North Park area, the Omar Passens sign count is just through the roof.
Yes.
Now, signs don't vote, as people may tell you. So it can often be a false indicator, but be that as it may, lots of signs.
One thing that's fascinating that Omar is not a part of is the mailers that have been coming. And the mailers are basically about one thing, Nathan Fletcher. And they're either bagging on him or touting him. And the big issue that's been highlighted that I didn't foresee is guns.
Yeah.
All guns all the time. And they track some of his votes in support of firearm, you know, rights, and then in support of, you know,
When he was in the assembly, he voted very favorably towards gun rights legislation, mm-hmm. overwhelmingly, and had a high rating from the NRA. The thing that's interesting about it is, like, it's just a more specific description of what he's done over the last 5 years, which is he went from being a Republican in good standing to now a Democrat that's running with, like, labor union support. So one of the things that would probably happen if you go through that transformation is you go from voting for gun rights to believing in gun regulation. So that's what's happening here. Now he's left to simply say, yeah, but I don't think that anymore. The issue he faces is he's not been in office to put any votes on the record that would counteract the previous votes he had on the record.
So he did vote for an assault weapon ban, right? Like the Democrats had that mailer come out and say, like, to respond to all this because they saw how big this was getting.
Yeah.
And you know, had Jerry Brown and Kevin DeLeon, everybody saying, like, this guy was all about firearm regulation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's gotten intense. And then, of course, Lori Saldana, she doesn't have any money of her own necessarily, but she is getting tons of support from the UFCW union and Mickey Kasparian, all about just
and
dragging.
And now a little backdoor support from the Lincoln Club.
Exactly. So the Lincoln, this was the most mind-bending of the pieces so far. Lincoln Club sent out a mailer touting how supportive Nathan Fletcher was of firearm rights and access to guns. And then on the other side, how this gun-grabbing liberal, Lori Saldana, wants to take it and clearly aimed at hurting Nathan, not necessarily helping.
It's very funny because the wording is designed to say that we are pro-Nathan, but it's a picture of him like shrouded in shadows, in darkness with a gun aimed at the person looking at the mailer, whereas Lori's got this like big beaming smile picture. It's in white and yellow, and it's people celebrating at an anti-gun rally.
They clearly wanted to thread the needle of saying guns are bad and you should not vote for them, but not saying that.
Because they support gun rights.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a fascinating discussion. And this debate, people are voting now. It seems like Bonnie DeManus will probably make the runoff. And so one of the others will.
It would certainly qualify as a shocking development if two Democrats advanced.
Right.
I don't know, man. I don't know anything anymore.
Yeah, so
I'm not prepared to weigh in.
I phrase it that way to be clear that I'm not making a prediction per se.
Right.
I'm simply attempting to establish a baseline by which we can either be shocked or not shocked on election day. Because, it's clear that we don't know anything. Remember at this time 2 years ago, we were discussing whether Ray Ellis could win outright in June because things would be so much worse for him in November. And then, in fact, it became like watching each batch of returns to see if Barbara Bree would, in fact, win outright.
Yeah, she almost did.
And then
there was Mara.
Yeah.
A lot of shocks.
She leapfrogged the more better-funded people in the city.
Georgia Gomez was presumed to be the third-place Democratic candidate in that race. She ended up winning.
So we don't know anything.
We don't know anything.
Yeah,
a couple of other issues that will get resolved, though, in around the county. So the Chula Vista half-cent sales tax, this is a big deal. Huge tax increase. Well, half-cent perpetual, so it's not going to sunset. Mm-hmm. Tax increase down there. Big issue. A lot of debate about that. And then
it's also
the National
a big
City
issue. It's also, and the Chula Vista is also a big, looking forward. You can only have so many tax increases at a time. People only are willing to approve so many. So if MTS or Sandag wants to go to the ballot at some point to increase taxes once again, well, Chula Vista has already taken some of that tax capacity in that jurisdiction.
Okay, if you're on the podcast, stay tuned. We'll have, of course, our hero and goat of the week, and then our guest, India Thusi, from California Western School of Law. This first part of the show is broadcast on our partner station at News Radio 600. We're back. So during the break, actually, we had we got a response. So Tom Wong, we had invited Tom Wong onto the show. He's a professor at UC San Diego, does a lot of work on the undocumented, unauthorized population in the United States. He actually has this long-term survey going, which I can't wait to see the final results or what books he puts out and stuff. Basically, he's, following hundreds of San Diego's undocumented immigrant population and asking them questions and following how their experience is as the Trump administration continues and such. And so he's done a lot of research. He's a very eloquent speaker on this. He's actually helping the state in its defense against the Trump administration's lawsuit. And we asked him to respond to Sam Abed's point that it's a fake news that people cooperate with police better if they have these sorts of policies in place. And he said, for example, in 2006, the Immigration Committee of the Major Cities Chiefs Association of largest law enforcement agencies, many of the largest law enforcement agencies in the U.S., it concluded that immigration enforcement by local police would likely negatively affect and undermine the level of trust and cooperation between local police and immigrant communities. And then he said his own work confirms that the undocumented immigrants in San Diego County are 61% less likely to report crimes they witnessed to the police if the San Diego Police Department and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department were working together with ICE. I would encourage Mr. Abed and other local elected officials to research the issues more closely rather than resort to sound bites. So, fascinating. He had a great piece about all this in the Washington Post as well. So check that out, Tom Wong in the Washington Post. The debate's not going to end, but we'll keep putting as much context on it as we can, right? All right, our hero of the week. San Diego City Council, are we going to do this?
Yeah, they're the preemptive heroes for their announcement that they'll be, again, tackling the vacation rental issue in July, where we are certain that they will solve it. Everything will come together. Nothing will derail it. We're really looking forward to that.
I mean, look, people have very differing opinions on this issue. The policies that they support have reached an impasse. There's no more room for cooperation. And it's clear that they're going to just resolve to vote on the matter and let the chips fall where they may. They would not do anything cowardly like
that. They have a date set, so July. I don't see how anything could go wrong.
It is unimaginable that they would bring down hundreds of residents to Golden Hall for hours of testimony to only not come to a decision. So that's not going to happen. And since that's not going to happen, we are safe to provide them a hero status for once and all for
all done.
Making this decision.
Once and for all, it's all being taken care of. July 16th is the day. If you care about vacation rentals in the city of San Diego, whether they should be allowed or not, it looks like the contours of a deal are coming together. Basically, the idea is some sort of minimum stay. You could rent out a whole house to vacationers, but they'd have to stay maybe two, maybe three nights. I guess that's still up for debate. Mm-hmm. There's also a debate about exactly how many different of these properties one owner can have. Those laws are crazy, by the way. Like the wife and kids can hold. You could gather a lot, it seems like. But I don't know. We'll figure something out.
What are you doing?
Sorry. I'm ruining the whole thing. Shoot. Sorry. There'll be some sort of fee and permitting and maybe a pullout for Mission Bay area, Mission Beach. But July 16th, that's the day, and we know they're going to solve it. They've never had a big meeting like this that doesn't result in decisive, strong action. The big difference, of course, this time is the mayor is fully involved. He's in. This is it.
This is it.
This is it.
This time, it is it.
This is it.
July 16th. All right, so stay tuned for that. Our GOAT of the week.
You lose! Good day, sir.
So this one goes to San Diego County, which came out in the last week or so with a report about how it responded to the hepatitis A crisis. If you'll remember, brought a lot of embarrassment to San Diego, a lot of heartache. At least 20 people died. Hundreds were sickened. You wouldn't really know that it was a tragedy from reading this report. The county said that there were areas of successes and areas for improvement.
Areas for improvement being the 20 dead people?
Yeah, maybe? That was a thing that we could improve, yeah. Presumably.
Right.
As well as, hundreds sickened, no access to restrooms.
So when you said successes and failures, presumably the successes were on an order of magnitude comparable to 20 people dying?
Well, there were people who didn't die.
Okay.
I'm just putting words in their mouth.
Lots of us survived. Yes.
Yeah. They highlighted, their innovative approaches, intense focus on the issue at hand.
Yeah, bravo. They did intensely focus.
I mean, if an airline crashed a plane and then wrote a report about all these wonderful things that they've done.
In fact, on that very day, the number of Delta Airlines planes that took off and landed without incident exceeded the one that crashed.
So the county grand jury came out with a report today as well. We're recording this on Thursday. That the county and the city discussed a number of possible responses to the crisis, but did not implement them for several months as the disease spread. and the number of deaths continued to climb. And that's not even really hitting as urgency as sensational as we might want to about how bad this went.
It was bad.
Right. I mean, yeah. So for instance, like 20 people died.
Yes.
That was a thing. 20 people died.
Yeah.
20.
So there is going to be apparently now a state audit, right?
Yeah, state audit and a city examination as well. And the county is expected to respond to this grand jury report also.
Okay, well, we'll see
how
they
mention their intense focus in
their innovative solutions
and the intense focus.
Okay, now we turn our attention to this debate we've been having now over the last several weeks about the difference and not difference between San Diego's sex working industry and its sex trafficking plague. And with that, we have India Tusi from the California Western School of Law.
Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored in part by the San Diego Tourism Authority. As a nonprofit news organization, we depend on our members, foundations, and sponsors like the San Diego Tourism Authority to provide funding to support the investigative journalism you expect from us. We are very grateful for all of our supporters, and we will recognize them during the show. From the 1 in 8 local jobs provided by the tourism industry to the $289 million in hotel room tax revenue generated for the city's general fund, San Diegans have many reasons to be proud to live in a destination powered by tourism. As a nonprofit organization with a mission of promoting travel to San Diego, the San Diego Tourism Authority celebrates what tourism means to our community. Find out why at sandiego.org/impact. And if you like Voice of San Diego's work and want to become a sponsor too, contact us at development@voiceofsandiego.org.
Okay, we are joined on the line by India Tusi. She's an assistant professor at California Western School of Law. She wrote a commentary for us this week about distinguishing sex work from sex trafficking. India, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, thank you for writing the piece. So you have a line in here that you said, you're referring to the district attorney candidate, Summer Steffen. You said, Steffen and other prosecutors in California conflate sex trafficking with sex work and are confusing the public in what seems like an attempt to inspire moral outrage. Why is it important to distinguish the two?
Well, you know, I think for both sex trafficking and for sex work, it's important to ensure the dignity and human rights of both sex workers and trafficking victims are being protected. However, by conflating these two, you're actually causing more harm for both of them because they need different types of resources. It leads to these overly broad policies and laws that fail to respect the autonomy of and dignity of sex workers and sex trafficking survivors. And it also helps to confuse the data, right? So in data collection, often when researchers are focused on sex trafficking survivors, what they're really focused on are people who have been forced into some sort of prostitution, right? So people who have been coerced or people who are also underage. So that's a completely different group that has very specific needs versus people who are entering into the work for other reasons but still are exercising some choice. And so by taking away their ability to actually say what their story was and what led them to the work and respecting their voices, you're actually depriving them from resources and remedies that would actually be beneficial to them.
So from in my outside perspective as a reporter, it seemed like the term sex trafficking kind of appeared out of nowhere and then was immediately everywhere, that interest groups started popping up dedicated to it. News stories would frequently happen that you'd hear about task forces and large, you know, prosecutions based on it. Can you give me a bit of history of when you started to see these two things being both distinguished from one another and conflated into one another as part of this movement?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, I think the use of the term, you know, sex trafficking has actually been a term that's been used since the early 1900s. And so the recent moral outrage around, you know, sex trafficking really started, I think, around the 2000s, mid-2000s or so, where there were some feminists who were really, you know, advocating to recognize this problem of sex trafficking. Part of the issue came in, though, when there were independent sex workers and sex worker groups that were stating, you know, we recognize that sex trafficking and coercion is a problem, but it's actually really different from what's our situation is and you know, our experience, and it's important that we distinguish between the two. However, some feminists felt that, you know, because women are choosing to do work that, you know, perhaps is undignified in some ways, that they're really being trafficked as well. And so you start to see the beginnings of this conflation, I think around the mid-2000s, and then, you know, slowly it started to pick up steam. And so now, you know, we're really at a moment where there's even a bit of a moral panic around it, right? So this idea that, you know, people can be taken away and, you know, it falls into this trafficking narrative, right? We even have some Hollywood movies that have been filmed around it. It's a really dramatic story, and that's part of the reason it's been able to capture the imagination of the public. But it's really something different than, you know, sex work and, you know, just prostitution as we've come to know it. But, you know, in an attempt to, you know, try to secure some rights in some ways for people who are sex workers, some individuals have been conflating the two and saying that, you know, it's all sex trafficking when it's really, you know, two different things.
One thing that I found really interesting about the piece that you wrote for us was you mentioned this big blockbuster study about the pervasiveness of sex trafficking in San Diego. And people bring up that study in basically every conversation that happens locally around human trafficking. And you suggested that it's maybe misleading people in certain ways, or people have kind of gotten the wrong impression from certain elements. Could you talk about parts of that? Because I just think it's like the thing that everybody in town points to of this is this huge pervasive problem. And if there are things that people are getting wrong about that study, I think that would be really important.
No, absolutely. So there was a study commissioned that was conducted by, I believe it was University of San Diego, as well as
Point Loma
Nazareth University. And so one part of the study states that, you know, the average age of entry for people who are sex trafficking survivors in San Diego is 16.1 years of age. And so that particular statistic has been used to suggest that the average age that people enter the sex trade, so that might be just prostitution that is not coerced, is 16. And that is really a misinterpretation and a misreading of what the report states. And the reason that this is important is because, you know, sex trafficking by definition includes all those people who are underage, right? So those people who are under 18 are automatically labeled as sex trafficking survivors. Right. And then in addition to that, you have people who have been coerced or are being forced to enter the sex trade. But that group is going to automatically skew a bit younger than the larger pool of people who are just entering sex trade voluntarily. Right. Because it includes all those people who are underage. However, despite this, you know, many people, perhaps they're not looking very carefully at the research or making this distinction in their own heads between sex trafficking versus, you know, sex work. Just take this study to mean that everyone who enters into the sex trade, the average age is 16, that's not what the report states. You know, the report is really clear about the fact that it's talking about sex trafficking. It's talking about people who are forced into prostitution.
Do you agree with the idea that anyone who has anything like a pimp or a relationship with somebody else that takes some of the money is part of a sex trafficking relationship?
You know, so I think, you know, to say that, to use a blanket statement that everyone who has some sort of intermediary that they're working with is a sex trafficking, you know, victim, I don't think that really, you know, I don't think that's going to be accurate in some situations. I think in many situations where you have an intermediary, like a pimp, as you know, is often called, then you might have that sort of, you know, sex trafficking relationship where there's coercion and where the person, where the individual is being forced into it. However, you know, from the research that I found, first off, many sex workers are independent workers, especially now, right, where a lot of people are doing their work using the internet, using other sorts of resources where they can be independent and be able to screen out their clients. You find a huge population of sex workers are actually independent and don't have any intermediaries, right? But oftentimes, you know, people are captured by this idea of a violent pimp who's doing, you know, some sort of abuse upon the sex worker, where the situation is a lot more complicated when you're actually on the field. Now, in terms of, you know, whether intermediaries are also always going to be lead to sex trafficking, I think it really depends. So an intermediary can be another sex worker herself, right? So it could be someone who has a friend who is unemployed or who recently became homeless, who is looking for work, and that person says, okay, go to this person. That person is functioning as an intermediary in that transaction. And you do see that happening quite often on the field. So it just really depends. It's not, you know, very black and white in terms of what people's experiences are.
Let me ask you, one of the things that we recognized as we started doing all these interviews with people in this race was that both candidates, Summerstuff and Genevieve Jones-Wright, say that they don't want to go after the prostitutes. They don't want to prosecute women, regardless of what spectrum of voluntary compliance they're participating in. They aren't going to prosecute them. So why is it important if everybody agrees that women involved in this trade aren't to be prosecuted or shouldn't be? What's the importance that the district attorney still distinguish between the sex trafficking and sex work after that?
Okay. So my understanding is that Summer Steffens indicated that in most circumstances, they wouldn't be prosecuted. But there may be circumstances where the person doesn't fit into this narrative of being the perfect victim or being a trafficking survivor where they may be prosecuted. So I think that might be a circumstance where, you know, this distinction matters, because I don't think we need to reduce them to just being victims or trafficking survivors to acknowledge that we probably shouldn't be spending all of our resources arresting sex workers just for them to be re-released to start this revolving door, because it's really not an effective way of using law enforcement resources, where instead perhaps we should be focusing on, you know, real sex trafficking syndicates and organizations. That way we can really curtail sex trafficking. So it's important to acknowledge that difference, because the only way that you're actually going to be able to target sex trafficking is if you actually are able to identify what it is, where there's coercion, where people are being forced, as opposed to just labeling everything as being some sort of force, right? Because their resources are going to be diverted away from these more serious instances. And I think the distinction is also important because you want to be able to form partnerships and trust with sex workers, right? And so even if you just say to the sex workers that you're not going to arrest most of them most of the time, I don't think that's going to be enough to really foster the type of trust that you need in that law enforcement relationship to ensure that they feel comfortable coming forth when they notice that there might be an individual who's being forced into a situation, or they notice that there are particular, you know, groups of individuals or people who are committing certain types of crimes. You know, so I think that's really important to have that trust relationship. And I think, you know, by calling sex work sex trafficking, you're also creating this additional stigma, right? Because, you know, in many ways, sex trafficking just sounds scary. It sounds worse. It sounds like this big thing. And, you know, it becomes, you know, it allows for more harsher penalties. And I think it's really important that we be clear with our labels.
In your op-ed, you indicated that there'd be a decent model to follow in communities that have decriminalized sex work. Why is that a preferred solution than simply creating a regulated legal industry, something along the lines of that we've seen in Europe or elsewhere?
I think the proper legal approach to sex work is going to depend on the specific location and what's happening locally. So, you know, in terms of San Diego, I think politically, we may be a ways off from actually being able to have, you know, full legalization that's regulated and, you know, operating in such a way where we're ensuring that we're, you know, maintaining public safety and, you know, other sorts of considerations. But, you know, I think for this next prosecutor, what they can do is decide, you know, where do we want to allocate our resources? Do we want to spend our resources focused on, you know, low-level prostitution, right? Because even though, you know, Simon Stafford has said that most prostitutes wouldn't be treated as criminals, you know, if in that situation where an individual recruits someone to become a prostitute and says that they should join the sex trade, that person can easily be labeled as, you know, a sex trafficker, right? Because of this label, right? And or you have these other situations where, you know, people are engaging in really low priority behaviors where we end up diverting a lot of resources after we've labeled them as sex traffickers. So, you know, it creates this confusion.
Do you think the legislation that shut down websites like Backpage will have an unintended consequence of making certain sex workers who had used that system to create a sort of their own situation where they didn't have to rely on pimps and they could do some sort of background research in the men that they were meeting up with? Will this have the unintended consequence of making them less safe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, even leading up to the legislation being enacted, you know, sex work advocate groups were stating that, you know, it's going to make things a lot more dangerous for sex workers, right? So now they are not able to, you know, use the internet to screen out clients. They're not able to be as selective. They're not able to, you know, use that as a medium to ensure that they're protected. And, you know, there's been a lot of research throughout the around the world that shows that, you know, sex workers who work in more indoor environments, who don't need to go to the street in order to engage in sex work, have much better outcomes in terms of, you know, whether they experience any sort of violence, whether they, you know, experience any sort of crime while engaging in sex work. It's just a much safer environment. And so by forcing, you know, removing any sort of, you know, internet outlets that they have, you know, this is actually going to be to the detriment of sex workers and even to sex trafficking victims by, you know, forcing things further underground and making them have to go to more dangerous markets in order to see clients.
Okay. And so one more question. You had indicated a few different issues you had with some of the ways people have interpreted the University of San Diego Point Loma Nazarene study. Can you help me put San Diego in context in terms of its sex trafficking, sex work, industry and situation here? I mean, obviously we're situated on the border, so I would assume that that makes us to some extent distinct, but we're also a self-contained community that has people who live and operate here only. Are we like other places? Are we unlike other places? In what ways would you describe San Diego as a region for sex trafficking?
You know, as you point out, Scott, one thing that makes San Diego different from, you know, a lot of other American cities is this proximity to the border. And, you know, we are right there next to Mexico. We have Tijuana right there. And so there is, you know, some valid concerns in terms of, you know, people being trafficked into the country or being forced into sex trafficking and prostitution against their will as a way for them to come into the country. And so, you know, that's going to have a more international dimension, and that's going to be part of, you know, thinking about sex trafficking in San Diego. But, you know, in terms of, you know, sex work in San Diego, in many ways, San Diego's like many typical, you know, big cities in the United States in terms of having, you know, a fair number of sex workers who are working voluntarily, maybe most of them working a bit part-time, so not necessarily people who always identify as sex workers, but people who might work, you know, for a few months for a particular reason and then go back to whatever normal jobs or school that they have, then return back to sex work. So you have a lot of that too happening in San Diego. But, you know, I think part of the reason why we want to separate out this, you know, this sex trafficking that often has this international element from sex workers, because you need a different response, right? So you need a different response if you're dealing with, you know, a group of individuals who are being forced into this country to engage in sex, you know, sex trafficking against their will, and maybe there's a connection with, you know, international organizations, international criminal syndicates. Your response to that is going to be different than to someone who, you know, is just on, you know, soliciting clients, you know, every couple of months in order to pay their college tuition bill. It's just two completely different things.
Right. Yeah. So what you're saying is not that it's okay or that sex trafficking is okay. You're saying, like, not distinguishing it makes it harder for you to prosecute and go after the people who are really being victimized and trafficked.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We want to be able to, you know, spend our resources, you know, targeted on sex trafficking and people who are being forced or coerced into, you know, working in under prostitution. And, you know, we want to be mindful of them and ensure that we are devoting the resources to them as opposed to, you know, just labeling everyone as a trafficking survivor.
Well, India Tusi, she's an assistant professor at California Western School of Law. Her commentary ran at voicesofsandiego.org this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.